Morning, Gordon DeGrace, America. It's Hugh Hewitt, special edition of the Hugh Hewitt Show, and I do mean special. You know, if you've listened to this program for any period of time, I love to talk to the people that move the culture, and especially when they're writers. So you've heard me do extended conversations with Stephen Pressfield, who wrote Gates of Fire, Tides of War, and most recently Killing Rommel. You heard an extended conversation with novelist Daniel Silva about the Gabriel Allon books. And many of you ever, after those conversations, have said, can you find Vince Flynn? And the answer is yes. And today we are going to spend the program talking with perhaps America's best-selling author over the last 4 years about what he does and why he does it, about Mitch Rapp and about terrorism. Vince Flynn, welcome to the Hugh Hewitt Show. Great to be have you with us.
Hugh, great to be on the show. I'm a big fan of yours as well. I got to tell you, my only gripe is that you come on in Minnesota as dusk is falling on the Twin Cities and the signal, usually, depending on what time of the year it is, goes from great to really bad.
Yep, that's that Patriot signal up in Minnesota. So we make you'll have to move closer to the station, I guess, Vince. Well, I'm glad to know you're a listener. Then you'll know a lot of the shorthand I'm going to use in the course of today's conversation. But let me begin by saying it's extraordinary your background, and let me give the audience a little bit about this. You're a big family guy, born in St. Paul, 1966, that makes you 42, went to St. Thomas Academy, then the University of St. Thomas, an extraordinarily good college up in the Twin City area. You tried to get in the Marine Corps as an aviator, you had a medical disqualification, and then you decided you were going to throw everything, despite dyslexia, at being a writer. That's a pretty good summary, right?
It is very good.
Now, but most people with dyslexia don't end up being the best-selling novelist in America. How daunting a challenge was that at the beginning of your writing career?
You know, it was a huge challenge at the beginning, but I also think that dyslexic kids, because you're wired a little differently, I think your brain is naturally a little more creative. And throw on top of that I come from a big family. I'm the fifth of seven children, you know, and I grew up I like to say, you know, that the tail end of the parents of the baby boom generation, my mom and dad are both 71, where my grandparents were still around, and you know, we only had three TV channels. Remember that growing up? You know, maybe you got four, but it was prior to cable. Cable came when I was in high school, and so people still sat around and told stories.
And go ahead.
My editor has told me from time, you know, time and time again, because early in my career I used to get a little worked up that the critics would shred me, you know, not enough character development, whatever, blah blah blah. And she'd always say, you know, listen, you've got a real talent here, and it's the best talent that any writer could hope for. You tell a great story. Ignore them.
Oh, please do, and keep ignoring them, because people want to read books that take them in and captivate them. And how many books have you sold, by the way?
Last count I heard was we were over 10 million.
Yeah, and the current one, Extreme Measures, that's the most recent one, is bestseller on the New York Times as we tape this. But I must tell people who are hearing about you for the first time, I can't imagine that, because that means they haven't been in an airport or a bookstore in the last 7 years, that they ought to start at the beginning. I know publishers hate when I say that, because then they don't go and they wait to get transfer of power, and then they go to the third option. But wouldn't you rather have a reader discover you from the beginning of the Rapp series and move on through?
I have no preference either way. What cracks me up about it, Hugh, is I've done this test before. I've had people get in arguments at my book signings over this. People say, you have to start at the beginning. Other people say, you have to do this. And I'll tell them, pull out your wallet.
Yep.
And the one person will pull out their wallet, and the one who says you have to start from the beginning and read it all the way through, their wallet is in perfect shape, the bills are organized perfectly. And the person who says, you can start anywhere, it doesn't matter what, their wallet is in shambles. They got a business card in there from 10 years ago. It's as fat as a brick. It really depends on the person.
That's very interesting, because I have a wallet like the latter, but I had to start at the former. Dwayne is laughing in there because I'm the exception that proves the rule, because I can't stand going backwards after I know what's happened in a character's life. But we'll come back to that in a moment. I still want to stay on bio a little bit, because when I bring people on the air who have, you know, taken up hundreds of hours in some instances of someone's life, they never know enough about you. They can learn everything about their character, but they don't know much about you. And I always love the high school summary, because that'll put you on the map for a lot of people. What was Vince Flynn doing at St. Thomas Academy in 1980 through 84?
You know, I was a very good athlete, which helped me get through school. and because I was a bad student. And St. Thomas Academy is an all-male Catholic military college preparatory school, and so they're not screwing around. And there's no easy classes, and so I was lucky to get by, you know, this, you know, C+, B- average. But, you know, the truth was, my dad had taught there, and I had older brothers who'd gone there, and my dad had gone there as well. So I had a little more to live up to than probably most people. But I, what this is the other thing that happens with dyslexic people, and there's one of the big newspapers or universities did a study a couple of years ago that came out about this is. Dyslexic kids grow up and they represent a disproportionate number of entrepreneurs. Like, you can look at lawyers, accountants, all these various fields, and the number of people who are dyslexic in those fields are very, very small. Now you look at entrepreneurs, you look at CEOs, and the number jumps. It gets really big because they become problem solvers at an early age. They can't do things the way everybody else does. So you have to, because you can't actually write well, and you don't do well on tests, the way you make up for things and the way you get by and don't get failed is you learn people skills. You learn how to suck up to your teacher. You learn how to verbalize in class because you can't write or read. And you learn ways around all the obstacles why the other kids just tend to go along with, you know, the conveyor belt. And the conveyor belt doesn't work for us, so you got to find different ways to do things. And, you know, I had a job year-round. I always tell my kids, because, of course, now because of my success, they're probably never going to have to do this. But Hugh, I had a job, if you can believe it, in high school. My junior and senior year, I worked every Sunday at an Amoco gas station from 9 in the morning to 9 at night with a 30-minute lunch break, and that was it. And Mr. Peterson, who owned the gas station, was a great guy, but we weren't allowed to sit down.
What?
We were not allowed to sit down because he didn't want anybody to come in and think that his employees were lazy. So there wasn't a chair or a stool in the place. And we would stand. And this is, you know, people were still doing full service back then.
Oh, yeah.
You know, coming in, and he'd run out, you know, be minus 20, and you're pumping their gas and changing oil and fixing tires. I loved the job. It was a great job. But, you know, it put a lot of things into focus for me.
You know, Vince Flynn, I bet you.
I'll for the rest of my life on Sundays. So.
I'll bet you the only internationally known celebrated author with 10 million book sales who's changed tires and pumped gas that way. There might be someone else. I have to ask Pressfield. He was kind of a screw off when he was a kid, too. But I don't think anyone else. No wonder you know so much about cars. That comes through, actually.
You know, and by the way, Stephen Pressfield is. One of my favorite authors, great guy, and when I do a lot of research with the SEAL teams, and it's based, his book Gates of Fire is basically required reading for every SEAL.
I'm not surprised.
They live by the ethos that he puts forth in that book, and Stephen's I think the guy's a national treasure.
He is. I think you and Silva and Pressfield are the big three for me, and that's why. I'm curious about, what do you read when you read to relax?
You know, I'm embarrassed to say it took me this long to read this book, but my wife and I just got back from our annual trip to Mexico. Every year we go without the kids, and I finally sat down and read Lone Survivor. And I had President Bush tell me to read it. I'd had friends at the CIA, friends at Special Forces. Everybody was telling me, you got to read this book. The problem I ran into, Hugh, was, when that book came out, I was under deadline for extreme measures. And I can't read anything that is either in my genre, fiction-wise or non-fiction-wise, while I'm writing.
I understand that. Explain that to people why.
Well, I'm paranoid that, and this, call it Catholic guilt or whatever, but I don't want to be accused of ever borrowing somebody else's ideas.
I thought so. Yep.
And so I don't even entertain the idea. In fact, there's some authors out there that I've heard about and people say you should read this, and I won't go there because I don't ever want to be accused of taking one of their ideas, so I don't even pick up their book. Now, I'll give you the exception to that rule, because I think our styles are so different, is Daniel Silva.
I'm not surprised.
Daniel is such, first of all, he's, I meet a lot of authors, and I don't want to take away from the other ones I've met, but Daniel's one of my favorite. He's a great husband, a great father, really actually a darn good sense of humor that doesn't really come out in his books because they're so serious. But he's just an all-around really good guy, and our styles are so different. that I, he's my, he and kind of Lee Child, especially Lee's earlier stuff, it's my opportunity every year to kind of read stuff that I kind of, I mean, I'm in the same genre, obviously, you know, the thriller, but I get to read their stuff and enjoy it and not really worry because our characters are, they're tough, strong guys, but they're very,
very different. We're going to come back and talk about that throughout the course of this interview. You tuned in, America. You're lucky. Vince Flynn is my guest for the entire program. All of his books are listed at HughHewitt.com. Stay there. 21 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt. My guest is novelist Vince Flynn, hyper best-selling author, sold millions of books. His current bestseller is Extreme Measures. You got 10 previous books or 10 total books on the Mitch Rapp series. You can go to Wikipedia or on my website anytime to figure out what they are. Vince Flynn, I'm still going to do a little more bio with you because obviously I looked at your bio and read a little bit around. You're Catholic to the core. Are you still practicing?
Yeah.
Okay. And what, tell me about your mom and dad, because this looks like it could have been one of these classic big Catholic families around whom I grew up and was part of. It tell me about them.
Well, it's a pretty great story because, you know, my father went to St. Thomas Academy as well, and then went to the University of St. Thomas, graduated, and started teaching back at St. Thomas Academy right after he graduated. And he coached basketball, football, and baseball there for 13 years. And then, as he puts it, you know, one day he woke up and realized that, you know, a teacher's salary at a private high school wasn't going to raise seven kids. So he left and went to work in corporate America, went to Borg Warner and then Control Data and then did some other things. And now they're retired and they spend their time, split their time between Mississippi and Minnesota. But he was a real stern taskmaster. I mean, we're talking about a guy who was more of the Vince Lombardi coaching style, very successful coach, won two Catholic state baseball championships, another basketball championship, and was quite a player himself. But, there was no screwing around, Hugh. I mean, there was no gray with him, which I found to be I didn't like gray. I didn't want gray. I wanted to know, you know, what I could get, what was right or what was wrong. And his whole deal was, you want to step over that line, you go right ahead and do it. But don't mope if you get caught and you got to pay the price.
Right, right.
And so he was there to really, you know, I used to joke because we have a 13-year-old and my wife is, she likes to go in and wake him up in the morning and rub his back, you know, kind of, come on, let's get out of bed. And when he started at St. Thomas Academy this year in seventh grade, he was having a hard time getting out of bed and getting ready for school. And I had been on tour and I came home. I said, no, this isn't going to work. This is how you do it. I started just like my dad used to do. 2 feet on the floor right now. That was what he'd say to wake you up. Get your butt out of bed. There's the time's ticking. There's stuff to get done. So that was my dad, but he was very fair. And then my mother was this a very successful wildlife artist in Minnesota in the Midwest. Did a lot of stuff with Ducks Unlimited, Pheasants Forever.
Oh wow!
So there was this creative side of the household as well. You know, she was the old Catholic mom who every kid in the neighborhood was welcome to come over and. We weren't allowed to leave the house or enter the house without giving her a kiss. You couldn't go to bed without saying, I love you. Now, of course, I didn't tell my father I loved him until his mother died, you know,
right.
I was in college because you never did that growing up. Now we say it all the time and the world has changed, but I always say they really showed me a unique roadmap of his discipline. He was one of those guys that was a list. Every day he had a list. It was with boxes that he would check off of things he had to get done.
Yep.
And my mom was more of, you know, she'd walk around the house, you know, saying happy, 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 yeah. You know, whatever makes you kids happy, you know, short of, you know, doing anything illegal. She was all for us, you know, trying to fulfill our own hearts. And she was always there to pick us up. And he was there to give us the swift kick in the butt when we needed it. And it worked out. I think, you know, I'm very blessed to have been raised in a household like that. You know, here's the other thing. I never went to bed worried that they were going to not be together in the morning.
Right.
And that was strange.
It's profoundly important, and it affects people. But, how important it is.
They fought. I mean, they fought, and they argued, and we were one of those classic Irish family where the dinner table was a time to discuss everything. And I took my lumps early, and you had my dad was all for it. You had to learn if you could not verbalize your opinions, in a logical manner, you were going to get your clock cleaned at the dinner table.
Right.
And your brothers and sisters were more than happy to do it to you, and it prepared me for life. But, you know, they would fight, but they would never go to bed upset with each other. And, you know, it was nice. I always look back on it now, how nice that was to never worry that I was going to wake up and Dad was going to be gone with all of this crap on the front lawn.
Now, tell me you're a Notre Dame fan.
You know, it's funny that you say that because I am. I grew up a diehard Notre Dame fan, and then something happened here.
What?
My best friend from high school, Thomas Patrick Tracy.
Oh, if he went to USC, we're done. But go ahead.
No, he went to Notre Dame.
Oh, okay.
And he became such an obnoxious Notre Dame fan that he turned me. I was already a Michigan fan from an earlier
book.
You're going to love the Michigan deal.
No.
I'm in seventh grade, and a kid named Chris Berkeley from Columbus, Ohio, moves in across the street. And within about 3 months, he turned me into a Michigan fan because he was so obnoxious.
Oh, because he was a Buckeye.
Yes. Oh, it was all he talked about. So, and I'm still a Notre Dame fan. In fact, this Charlie Weiss deal, it kills me. It's college football is not as much fun when Notre Dame is stinking it up.
You bet. And they're going to get better, and they have to. Otherwise, I'm going to have to leave the California state because USC people. You want to talk obnoxious, Vince Flynn. You had to come live out here for a couple of years.
I've heard.
Even further in time. Before St. Thomas Academy, what's the name of your elementary school?
Westview Elementary.
Oh, so you went public. You didn't have the nun.
My parents made it when we were little. We were born in the Nativity Parish in St. Paul, and then they moved out to Apple Valley, which is a suburb about 20
I know Apple Valley
outside of the Twin Cities, and they made a decision then that, you know, brand new public schools, good school system, and we're all going to church out there still. So they sent the little ones to public grade school, and then we all went to Catholic high schools. The girls went to Holy Angels.
Got
the boys went to St. Thomas Academy.
Got it. A lot of people in Ohio did the reverse. Well, now tell me a little bit about the craft. I always want to make sure when I talk to Pressfield and Silva, a lot of young authors, the first thing they always ask me when I'm doing one of these things is find out how you sold your first book. So let's start there. Then we'll go talk about the craft. How did you break in?
How did I break in? I'll tell this story in two parts. The first is I am sitting in my cubicle at the age of 27, working for an outfit called United Properties, which is a commercial real estate and property management firm in the Twin Cities. And once you turn 27, you can no longer serve in the United States Marine Corps as an officer. Now, they grant waivers now that we're at war, but back then they weren't granting any waivers. And Hewitt came crashing down on me like a ton of bricks. I had never gone for anything in my life as hard as I'd gone for trying to be a Marine aviator and failed at it. And, you know, I was medically disqualified because of some concussions I'd had as a kid. And it really stuck in my craw. I'm not a Buddhist, so I think we got one shot at this. And you can't turn back the clock. And so I said, you know, I'm never gonna live my life and not realize another dream. Because what was eating at me, Hugh, is I could have gone Marine infantry as an officer.
Right.
And I didn't for a variety of reasons, some of which, you know, my father and some other people counseled me, you know, you really want to go in with a skill. This is, by the way, the, you know, late 80s, early 90s, when people were still high on the airlines, that was a great job, you know, it was a great way to move forward in life and retire basically when you're 50. And
hold on to that thought. We got to go to the break with Vince Flynn. I'm coming right back. I want to hear this story without interruption. Vince Flynn is my guest, Meta, big best-selling author, creator of Mitch Rapp. And amazing conversationalist, I'm discovering. Don't go anywhere. Lots more ahead. The whole show, in fact, on the Hugh Hewitt Show. Welcome back, America. It's Hugh Hewitt with Vince Flynn on a special Hugh Hewitt Show. The entire program talking with America's best-selling author. Millions and millions of his books are all over the country, and they've given countless hours of enjoyment and education, as I'll be talking about today, to the public at large. But I'm so screwed here. I've messed up my outline already. I'm way behind, but I just, we're going to go where it goes. When we went to break, Vince, you were telling us, I had asked you, how did you sell your first book? How'd you break in? And you were talking to us about the fact that the Marine Corps would not let you be an aviator because of concussions when you were young. And
yep.
You're sitting in your cubicle at 27, not wanting to regret something else.
Yeah, I didn't want to regret something else. So I said, I've got this idea for a book. I had a friend out of college, a real sad story. He went to University of St. John's, about an hour north of the Twin Cities. He's the youngest of nine kids from Omaha, Nebraska. His name is Dan Hutz, and he moved out to Washington, D.C. after graduation and was there for 5 days and was shot and killed on Capitol Hill.
Ugh.
Was mugged right with his girlfriend. His older brother was out there fixing up houses on Capitol Hill. And I know you spent a lot of time in Washington, Hugh.
Yeah.
Most people who weren't around it don't remember how horrible D.C. was in the late 80s.
Right.
And it was a real cesspool. And I just at the time, about the same time, I'd read a book called Washington Waste from A to Z by Martin Gross. And I just thought, what is wrong with this country? That, you know, the youngest of nine kids from Omaha, Nebraska, great kid, can show up in our nation's capital and get killed literally two blocks from the Capitol at 9 o'clock at night with his girlfriend. And
mind-boggling. Yep.
There's really wrong with it. So that's what gave me the impetus to sit down and write term limits out of frustration. And I had been journaling that idea for a couple of years, and I finally said, you know what, I'm going to do it. I'm going to quit my job. I don't believe you can anything that's really worth doing and is competitive and fulfilling. You're not going to do it part time unless you're incredibly gifted. And I wasn't incredibly gifted. I had to learn a lot. I mean, I took two English classes in college and got C minuses in both of them. So I had an upward hill. But I thought the other thing here is people always say, "How'd you think you could do it?" Every time I sat down and watched a movie or read a book, and that's another story. I always knew what was going to happen. And the other thing I should back up and tell a real quick story. I'm taking a class pass fail my junior year in college, and I'm not there to pick up the paper. A buddy in the class picks it up for me. I show up at lunch the next day, and there's the paper sitting in the middle of the lunch table with about 10 of my buddies sitting around. And on the back of it is a big red F, and underneath it says in red letters, a very, very politically non-correct, by the way. It says, "I don't know how you got into college. I don't know how you're going to graduate. This is the worst paper I have read in all my years of teaching." Now, it's a pass-fail class, okay? And I didn't give it my best effort, but still, I was still hiding my problem.
I
wasn't confronting the fact that I was dyslexic. And I'd taken special classes when I was a kid, but I was really out of sorts with it. And my parents had been trying to get me to read for years. And so I finally sat down and I said, you know what, screw this. This is too embarrassing. I've got to confront this. And I'd been told by my counselors when I was little, you know, the only way to really fix this is you got to read. And so I picked up Trinity by Leon Uris because my mom and dad had been trying
Amen.
To
Amen. Great book.
And it took me 100 pages to get through it. It took me like a long time to get through the first 100 pages because it was so slow to start with. Then I was hooked. You know, the next thing I know, I'm crying. It's a very emotional novel.
Yep.
And all of a sudden, I'm reading everything I can get my hands on, Ludlum, early Clancy, the whole deal. And every time I picked one of these up, I knew what was going to happen. And it's so bad now, Hugh, I recite lines for movies and TV when I'm sitting on the couch next to my wife before the actor says it.
An intuitive sense of story.
Mind.
You just have an intuitive sense of story where it has
yeah,
to be.
Yeah, I think so. And so I thought, you know, Hugh, maybe you're one of the only radio people I could talk to who would fully understand this. Being raised, my father was a big Irish Catholic. I mean, with a capital I-C.
Yep.
Who really did not like the British. And I grew up hearing all about Oliver Cromwell and the Orangemen and, you know, the whole thing.
You bet.
And he was adamant to all seven of his kids, you are no greater and you are no less than any person that you will ever meet in this country. And never forget that. And he would pound that into us over and over and over and over. So I was given a talk a couple of years ago, and somebody said, you know, what made you think you could write these books? And I said, well, I thought to myself, if Tom Clancy can do it, why can't I? And a large number of people in the audience began snickering. And I realized, like an embarrassed child, oh, my God, they think I'm conceited. And it took me a while to kind of get the idea back, and then I said, I got to back up and explain something to you people. I'm not being conceited. I just literally, I was naive enough and egalitarian enough to think that if Clancy could do it, why can't I?
More on that when we come back. Vince Flynn is my guest. This is amazing. Stay tuned. I'm sure you will. 44 minutes after the hour, America. It's Hugh Hewitt. Fascinating special show. Talking with Vince Flynn, America's phenomenally successful thriller novelist. His new book, Extreme Measures, in bookstores everywhere right now. I am one of those people that they start with Transfer of Power, even before that, and go through them all. But whatever you do, you'll love them. Vince Flynn, we went to break. We're talking about you. You were naive and egalitarian enough to take up the pen or the typewriter or the word processor. But after you started and you finish your first book, or you at least get a draft of it,
yep.
How do you, in the middle of nowhere, Minnesota, 27 years old, with a crummy academic record and dyslexia get to market?
I started sending out the letters, you know, to all the agents and the publishers and the editors, and you'll relate to this. I began to the rejection letter started to come back in. So what did I do? I used to pin them up on my bulletin board one after another, right where I write, where I would sit there and write, and I'd say to myself, I'm going to show you. Every day I'd pin up a new one. I'd say, I'm going to show you. I'm not going to quit. And I didn't realize it, Hugh, as a kid, how competitive my father had made us all.
Huh.
I just thought, in the high school that I went to, I just thought that's the way everybody was. And I didn't realize until much, much later in life that culture that my parents gave us is very different than a lot of how other people are raised.
Yeah.
And so another quick story. Senior year high school, we're playing Creighton, our arch rival, and that's where a lot of great football players go to school. And we had a 18-year streak on the line against beating Creighton. They were the other male Catholic military high school in town. And at halftime, we are winning 7-0, and I play defense. I'm a defensive end. And we walk into the locker room. And by the way, Chris Walsh is the starting quarterback for Creighton.
Oh, okay.
Who went on to win a national championship at Miami and play in the pros and everything. And our coach, Jerry Brown, comes in. He starts peeling off his jackets, and he's yelling and screaming, and he starts reaming me up and down the, you know, Vinny Flynn, you little blankety blank, blank, blank. I'm so sick of watching you pee down your pant leg, and blah, blah, blah. Get the hell out of this locker room.
Huh.
And you know, I get tossed out of the locker. And now, keep in mind, I play defense. They haven't scored. We're winning 7-0. But again, this is old school. This is Herb Brooks. This is, you take the one guy on the team who you think can take it, and he's your lightning rod, and you use him to light everybody up. And I didn't, you know, you didn't think much about it at the time, other than the fact that you're near being crushed. Well, you translate that later into life, and if you can survive that, who really cares if you get a rejection letter from somebody in New York who you've never met?
Right.
That you're opening in the privacy of your own home.
Right.
So I didn't let this stuff get me down. In fact, I kind of used it to fuel me. So after a year of all this, I end up, and you're actually going to love this story, because I'm to make ends meet, I'm bartending at night. I've now finished the book. And I'm looking to make some extra money, so I'm painting for this guy named Daryl, who I knew from the bar, who had a good painting business in town. And I am standing in Vice President Mondale's kitchen in Minneapolis, painting his kitchen. And I call my agent that I got down in Texas, and I fire her. And then I call up the three editors in New York who had the manuscript for 6 months but couldn't make up their mind. And I said to them, I want you to reject my manuscript and send it back to me. And they were shocked because they'd never had anybody say this. They're like, whoa. I said, I'm going to self-publish it. I had worked for Kraft General Foods out of college, and I had this idea, Hugh, that I was going to be like a minor league baseball team or like a local band. I'm going to publish locally. It's going to go well, and then I'll take it to the next level.
Yep.
And they thought I was nuts. So I sold 25% of Term Limits and raised a bunch of money. I put together a business plan and approached all these guys in town who had read the book and thought it was good. And then I self-published it and went to number one in the Twin Cities. And then, lo and behold, they all came running back. And I signed a two-book deal with Simon & Schuster for, it was $500,000 at the time.
Wow.
Which, you know, I was going, this is fantastic. And I have stayed with Simon & Schuster, and my imprint is Atria Books and Pocket, the entire time.
Well, they do wonders by you, by the way. Just the look and feel of the books. They're wonderful.
Yeah. I have been so lucky. I always say, I'd really like to get through this life with one publisher, one editor, one agent, and one wife. And so far, that's the case.
Are you also going to go with one picture? Actually, the picture's different now on Extreme Measures, finally. I was going to say, what, you're not aging over all these years in success? So.
It's every 2 years they reshoot the photo.
It's the same.
You do too. And you want to know something else?
What?
You know how painful those photo shoots are?
Yes.
You've done them?
Yes, I have. Yep.
They fly me to New York, and I sit there surrounded by a bunch of people who are, let's just say, they're not like the guys I grew up with. And they are fussing with my hair and putting makeup on me and, you know, and putting paper clips on my suit coat. And you know, it's just, it's...
tucking kerchiefs in your collar so they make up that. I know, I'm sure you're very comfortable with that. Before we run out of time on this segment, I got to ask you, though, where do you actually do your writing? This is another craft question. Do you go to the same place at the same hours and get and discipline yourself that way?
I try. I got two things. They're both great setups. One is the cabin. We've got a cabin over in Wisconsin that's about an hour and a half from our house. And last year, the last 2 years, I've been under such tight deadlines, I move up there for the summer. And Lisa comes up on Thursday night with the kids, and she'll drive back on Tuesday morning, and I write 7 days a week. But it's a fun experience. You know, I'll get out of bed at 6 in the morning, dive in the lake. It's cold. I write pretty much all day long. And then my big treat, and this is where you come into play, is I open a bottle of wine, I grab a cigar, and I go out on the pontoon, and I either listen to you or the Twins. And I can listen. It depends if the Twins are. I hate to say this to you, but if the Minnesota Twins are playing, I don't listen to you.
That's okay, even though they're lousy and they've beaten the Indians a couple of times in the stretch here in the last 10 years.
But then, if not, I listen to you. But then, as soon as the sun starts to go down,
yep,
I lose you.
Especially if you're in Wisconsin, we don't get so far.
Yeah, so
in Wisconsin.
I sit there with a notepad, and I write down what's going to happen tomorrow. Now, I already have cute index cards filled out. I love index cards. I write down all my ideas on index cards. I set up timelines, major scene summaries, you know, character summaries. But now we built a new house, and it's kind of been my dream. I've always wanted to walk across a motor court to a carriage house and work above the carriage house. And so we just moved in back in October, and that's where I'm sitting right now. And it's, you know, I got a fireplace up here, and it's just fantastic.
Well, we're going to be right back in Vince Flynn's carriage house and his wheelhouse as we talk to him about how he grows Mitch Rapp. When we come back, don't go anywhere. It's Hugh Hewitt Show. 55 minutes after the hour, America, it's Hugh Hewitt, concluding the first of 3-hour conversation with Vince Flynn, America's superstar, thriller author. His most recent book is Extreme Measures. You're going to love them all. I'm sure most of you who are listening have at least read one and probably all of the Vince Flynn novels. Now we're going behind the scene. We'll talk more about the issues raised by the novels in the next 2 hours after I get through talking a little bit about how they get made. Vince, this is a very short segment, but you just mentioned something that I find a little bit interesting, how you do character summaries on note cards, and then you say you plan what's going to happen the next day. When you sit down to write Extreme Measures or Separation of Powers, or Memorial Day, I'm naming some of my favorite ones here. Do you know the whole arc of the story when you start?
I used to plot the whole book out. And then what I found out, Hugh, was I'd sit down and I'd start writing it, and invariably a better idea always came along. So what I now do is, the best way to describe it is, I say, all right, I'm gonna leave Minnesota. I know I'm going to California. I don't know exactly where I'm going in California, because I know roughly how the books are going to end. But I don't know exactly where I'm going in California, but I better start heading west. And I better start working my way south. And so what I do is I outline the first third of the story.
I see.
And I sometimes I barely get through that third. What happens with me is I sit down and I shut everything out. I can't have the internet. I can't have phones. I can't have anything. I listen to music when I write. And you know what? And the other thing that kills me is when I go into deadlines, I don't listen to talk radio, and I'm a talk radio junkie.
Yeah.
And so I deny myself a lot of these things that I, you know, because I have to focus, and I just write. And it occurred to me finally with writing the last couple books, if I don't know exactly where the story is going to go every day when I sit down, I have a rough idea. There's no way that the reader can figure it out.
Yeah.
I mean, think about that for a minute.
Sure, it makes perfect sense.
You'd be a little predictable. And I don't know how you are. I assume you're the same way when you prepare for the show. You've got, you know, a bullet list of things that you want to talk about. But you can feel it when something good starts to happen on the show and you start to take off on a certain topic, or you get a good caller. You're willing to throw that script out the window.
Well, that's why my script is in ruins here. I've got 3 pages of notes, and it's in total disarray. I got 10 books. I haven't mentioned one of them yet. I've got questions on each book. I want to know, you know, why did you put Ruby Ridge and Waco into Transfer? You know, I got also, but the conversation's too good. So you go where the conversation goes.
Well, thank you. And that's how you write. At least that's how I write.
Wow, this is amazing. We're going to come right back. Vince Flynn is my guest, and this is gold. And I thought, I knew it would be gold, but I didn't know it would be this good of gold. Don't go anywhere, America. Go over to HughHewitt.com. Again, I think you should start with Transfer of Power. I think you ought to make sure you've got them lined up in the right direction. But if you can't help yourself and you're getting on an airplane tonight, I can assure you, you can read Extreme Measures and still enjoy them all. And in fact, Extreme Measures is going to rock your world a little bit. We'll be right back. Hour number two, straight ahead with Vince Flynn on The Hugh Hewitt Show.